It's time for Skin in the Game, and we have your front row seat to the action with marketing expert John Simperman and sports business journalist Tim Oshai.
They're talking about a $1 billion renovation.
Which is incredible.
And that's
for a hockey arena in the South, right?
But that includes hotels, that includes multi-use.
Skin in the Game brings you the fresh and fascinating business news in the world of sports, a multi-billion dollar industry that has an economic impact on all of us.
This week, we talk with the author of The Golden Generation, Orrin Weisfeld, about the history, origin, and the growth of basketball in Canada.
It was very early on here, one of the biggest sports, but it took a long time to have the mainstream appeal that it has today. But it had these niche pockets around the corner, dating back to really the invention of the game.
Coming up next on Skin in the Game, right after this.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley has winter fun everyone can agree on. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Holiday Valley features mountain coaster rides, snow tubing, the Tamarack Club Spa, and of course, skiing and snowboarding. At Holiday Valley, you can just relax too. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim Oshai.
So, Tim, we're going to talk some basketball.
Love it. It's been a while.
Specifically, Canadian basketball and the history, the origins, and the growth. We have joining us Orrin Weisfeld, who is really the Canadian historian when it comes to the history of basketball.
Yeah, Orrin is one of the preeminent journalists in Canada, covering the growth, and it's an impressive story of Canada's national program.
Right.
We think of Canada as a hockey country, and it is. Canada is very, very, very much a basketball country, and it has been that for a long time, and it's getting bigger.
Well, if you recall, the game of basketball was invented by a Canadian, Dr. James Naismith.
Yeah, and he did it in Springfield, Massachusetts, which gets all the credit and the, Basketball Hall of Fame. But yeah, and I got to tell you, until I read Orrin's book, The Golden Generation, I did not know that James Naismith was from Canada. The information's out there, but like many things, it's a little tidbit that gets lost in history.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look forward to chatting with Orrin, so do stay tuned for that. But before that, there is some updates and some news, and I think it is important that we recognize the U.S. hockey teams, both the men and the women, for two thrilling games against two exceptional competitors. That's our friends up north, and both games in overtime, won in dramatic fashion.
Amazing, amazing hockey. And this is not an original thought, but it was a dominating thought for me, John, which is this is the absolute best hockey probably anybody has seen played at any point. On the women's side, on the men's side, you will not find a higher level of hockey anywhere in the world than what we just saw in the Olympics.
Yeah, and I would absolutely agree. I think that, there are milestone events that can turn the tide for a sport, and I do think this is one that is going to benefit not only this hockey here in the United States, but I really think benefit hockey across the globe. And just as the hockey in the Miracle on Ice in 1980 produced someone like Mike Modano, and there's, the whole World Cup of Hockey team in 96 kind of created the Patrick Kanes of the world, right? This, both, again, men and women, the eyeballs on these games, the excitement, the drama, the speed, the everything, I think it is going to do a great deal of good for fandom, filling up arenas, as well as participation, getting more kids on skates.
For sure. And I'm so excited to see what I hope is a huge impact on the PWHL, the Professional Women's Hockey
for
League.
Sure.
John, a few weeks ago, we were talking about the success of some of the recent, tour games that the PWHL held. In other words, takeover games where they went to another city that doesn't have a team there full time, and they took over an arena and, you know, are filling NHL size arenas. Even a year ago when we had on one of their top executives, we were talking about how we want to see that, you know, that league expand
right.
and start playing in NHL arenas in every city and filling them. I think what we just saw at the Olympics could be a major step toward motivating fans, more and more fans, to get out and see what many people have already discovered is an incredible hockey product.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And, you know, and the timing of the games, again, both men and women, I'll just touch a little bit on the Sunday morning start on NBC, which, you know, some folks saw as a negative. Oh, my goodness, 8 a.m.? Here's the beauty
Bars
of it.
Bars opened early.
Well, yeah, but here's the beauty of it. You know, you had a lot of kids home,
yeah.
right? Too often, whether it's World Series is a good example, you know, they start these games too late, and the next generation of fans are often already tucked away. A Sunday morning, you get the eyeballs, you have breakfast, you watch some great hockey. I think it's going to do wonders for increasing the fandom of the sport.
I'm thinking too about how this translates over in North America. The NHL's had a lot of success. I mean, I don't know that the NHL's in a position where it necessarily needs a huge boost. It feels like they've been doing well, but what does this do for the NHL in your view?
Yeah, and I think it's hockey in general. And what I mean by that is I think local, you know, minor league hockey, USHL, AHL, the women's league, I think it's just, you know, more people who got the first taste of how exciting the sport is are now going to look to seek out other places to watch the game. We'll keep watching this story, and I think it's super quantifiable. You know, USA Hockey has numbers of every participant. It'll be really interesting to see what those numbers look like next year with the enrollment versus what they are right now. So super exciting there. Also, speaking of international competition, and as we bring in our guests to talk a little bit about basketball, I don't know if you noticed a few weeks back, the NBA changed the format with its U.S.-based or U.S.-born players versus European-based players. Kind of, you know, U.S. versus the rest of the world in a all-star game format. It was actually the highest rated NBA all-star game in 15 years by just changing up that format a little bit.
That's great, and we're seeing this now in multiple sports, right? Country versus country, continent versus continent. There's ways to do competition really, really well. It speaks to a bigger societal, a place where we are in society right now about country versus country, continent versus continent. Sports are a reflection of society, and, you know, in a sense, that's where we're at. But you talk about, you know, guys who are, again, playing on the same teams, right, in their individual cities week to week, month to month through the season, mixing it up, being able to show that love for their home country,
right,
fight on behalf of their home country, and then, you know, a few days later, back to their cities, back to regular play. I think it's great for the sport, and it's exciting.
Yeah. Well, it also goes to show how much international talent there now is in a league like the NBA, right? I think it would have been hard to have, you know, Europe versus USA in basketball 10, 15 years ago. But now, you know, the players coming over here from Europe, you know, are at obviously the top level and is as competitive as the U.S. born players.
Yeah, and what that can do for participation, to your point about hockey, but for basketball in this case European countries,
right,
it could have an amazing effect.
Right. Well, let's also get to our interview with Oren. Oren Weisfeld is a historian and author, and we're going to talk a lot about the game of basketball north of the border in Canada, and the growth of the sport, and hopefully where the game is continuing to grow to. So do stay tuned. Oren Weisfeld coming up here on Skin in the Game.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Whether it's a beginner's or Black Diamond Trail, Holiday Valley features skiing and terrain at every level. There's also a team of snow sports instructors available to sharpen your skills and build your confidence. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Skin in the Game. I'm in the studio here in Buffalo, New York, and John is joining us through a screen from Denver, Colorado. And Oren Weisfeld, I believe you're joining us, I'm guessing, from Toronto. Am I right?
Yeah, Toronto, Ontario.
Very nice. Well, great to have you, and so excited to talk about the Golden Generation. Tell us a bit about the premise for the book and your motivation for writing it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk to you guys about the book. I guess it goes back for myself to, you know, I started in the industry covering the Raptors for a blog called Raptors Republic, and eventually started to go to some games, cover a bit more of the NBA and the Raptors. And that was about in 2018. And each season I went, I just saw more and more Canadians, not just like getting to the NBA, which was a big deal in its of itself, but also like playing their way into real like all-star, all-NBA, MVP conversations. And so I think I wanted to just understand, we've only ever had for all of our history one, two Canadians in the NBA at any given time during the Steve Nash era, or you want to go back beyond that to Todd McCullough and some of these big men we had, Bill Wennington back in the 70s. But all of a sudden, we had 15, 20, 25 players in the NBA at the start of this season. So I wanted to understand like why that sudden boom in talent, why it was happening now. I was also saying in terms of like the motivation, and this is a kind of deep cut for your audience, but Delano Banton was drafted by the Raptors in 2021. And most people probably don't know Delano Banton. He's currently playing overseas. He was in the NBA a couple of years, but he's gone now. But he's a Toronto kid, born and raised in Toronto, played in Canada for a lot of his high school career, did a couple years of college, and then the Raptors drafted him in 2021 in the second round. And all of a sudden, everyone rushed to profile him, right? It's a good story. But I was like, how come this kid from Toronto, he was a BioSteel All-Canadian, which is our version of the All-American, McDonald's All-American game. He's an NBA prospect. How come nobody knew about him, right? So I wanted to shed a little bit more light on not just the NBA players that everybody knows, but also like a little bit more on the grassroots movement, a little bit more on some of the people who behind the scenes are coming out of Canada. Because yeah, now there is so many that some are going to the NBA, some are going overseas to play professionally. But I feel like we kind of have a responsibility to put more of a spotlight on these guys and help the public understand a little bit more about their stories. And so that was a bit of a motivation too, is just to kind of like help put a spotlight on the game beyond just what's happening at the Raptors or the NBA level too.
Well, Oren, hey, John Simperman here. Thanks for joining us too. Love talking hoops. How is basketball doing in Canada on the grassroots level? And I preface this by, you know, we know there's growth in soccer. Hockey, quite frankly, has had its ups and its downs when it comes to enrollment in Hockey Canada. How is basketball doing in the country?
Yeah, so it's a good question at this time, because I don't know if you guys are hockey fans, but the World Juniors just ended. Canada was ousted by Czechia for the third year in a row, I believe, which is kind of like shocking in Canada. We used to always win that tournament for a long time. And naturally, what happens when Canada disappoints in hockey tournaments is people take to like Twitter and go like try to find answers, right? And
right.
I've seen all these people giving their reasoning for what you said. Why is hockey participation dropping so drastically at the youth level? You guys just had Rick Westhead on, so obviously there's a culture to it. I don't want to like diminish that. It's a huge component. I also think what's lost in that conversation is there's kind of just better options for parents and young kids. And soccer is certainly one of those options, and basketball is another one, right? It's cheaper, it's more accessible. For new Canadians, it's going to be more represented. You know, you're going to see people who look more like you playing it at the highest level, who come from your neighborhood playing it. Basketball is growing incredibly quickly. Soccer and basketball are the two most common team sports in Canada now. And in certain provinces like Ontario and Quebec, like basketball is the most played sport at the school level too. It's certainly growing in that regard. And then beyond that, when you get into a little bit more of like the elite sport side of it, we have some of the best prep schools in the world. We have some of the best AAU programs, club programs. The boys' national team is doing well. The men's national team is certainly a medal contender. Basketball is, I would say, it's thriving in Canada. It's thriving especially for the elite. And maybe we'll get into this at the end. But in terms of like the average kid who just wants to play basketball and have fun, maybe not as many great options, because it is similar to America. It's a market model. Money wins out.
We talk a lot here about the kind of the commercialization of, mm-hmm. of youth sports, which, you know, we could really go down that rabbit hole. But I think you brought up a great point, though. It's still, though, more accessible to even do a pickup game around the, you know, around the corner than it is to lug yourself to an ice rink at, you know, 6 a.m. So there's definitely an accessibility opportunity there as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people start their love for the game in exactly that way, just taking a ball to a hoop and shooting yep. around.
Oren, when I was reading The Greatest Generation, there's a point you make in the book, a piece of history you describe that I'm going to ask you to dig into here. In 1971, Pierre Trudeau, who was prime minister back then, opened up immigration in Canada. That had a real effect, as you write, on the pool of people who were available to play basketball, and had a big impact on the game. So tell us more about the impact of opening up immigration on the sport of basketball.
Yeah, of course. I think the story of Canadian basketball is also a story of immigration. And I think in the 70s, when we had a progressive leader in charge in Pierre Trudeau, who is the father of the most recent prime minister, when he opened the borders for the first time in Canadian history beyond Europe, that obviously had a profound impact on the demographics of the country. And it meant that for the first time in history, non-white immigrants could really come to Canada. So yes, there was people from Africa and Asia certainly coming, but at the same time in the early 70s, West Indian countries like Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago declared independence. And so their nationals started migrating in large numbers to Canada, where it was a more established country, there was maybe more opportunities. And so what happened was we saw huge migration from the West Indies, and a lot of these people naturally took to basketball. It was more affordable. It was more accessible. That's what maybe they played. It was either soccer or that they might have played back in their countries. It certainly wasn't hockey. And the book starts with a lot of those first generation Canadians. And they played basketball. They really enjoyed it. A lot of them did get scholarships. Some of them went pro and played overseas. But first generation immigrants, in a lot of cases, at least in Canadian basketball, you know, like, they didn't really come to the game early enough or with enough resources and infrastructure around them to play in the NBA, for example, or to make a career out of playing overseas. Most of them just kind of picked it up in like high school and then got good enough by the time they were in grade 12 that some of them were lucky enough to get an NCAA scholarship. But we had no infrastructure. And that's why, like, in that era, our national team in the 70s and 80s was really good, consistently went to the Olympics, placed fourth a couple times, but we did not have like any NBA players. We did not have any sort of like pipeline of players going to the NCAA or to the pros. And a big part of this book was kind of like detailing that infrastructure, how it got built, and how for a lot of second generation immigrants, that's when it was in place for them to take advantage of.
Then you talk about, you know, there's players like, you know, a Steve Nash, for example, which is that next generation. Was there a grassroots pivot point where now these guys were playing at the most elite levels of basketball, in that case, the NBA?
Steve Nash, I would say, is an exception to the rule. He was actually a first generation immigrant. He was born in South Africa, but he moved to Victoria when he was very young. He basically had no other NCAA interest other than Santa Clara. So right. He was very emblematic of a lot of those first generation immigrants that I mentioned that were really good in high school. In some cases, like Steve Nash, probably the best high school player in Canada at the time, and still no scouts crossing the border, no kind of AAU infrastructure to go over the border and showcase themselves. He got very lucky. And once he got to Santa Clara, he obviously took advantage of it. But in terms of that key point in the grassroots infrastructure, I think the biggest thing that happened was in the early 2000s, a guy named Roe Russell basically founded the first AAU program in Canada, and that was called Grassroots Elite. And he just basically started taking, you know, white vans, you know, 12-seaters, taking a bunch of the best players that he saw in the Toronto area, and he just took them to small AAU tournaments in the States, you know, starting in places like Buffalo, close to the border, eventually going bigger, taking planes to Vegas or California. That was, I think, the key point, because there weren't scouts coming to Canada unless you were like a 7-footer and like you really commanded it. But we had to go down to America, take advantage of this really kind of rich infrastructure that had already been developing for, you know, 4 or 5 decades at that point. And him being the first guy to really take that AAU off, bring all the best players together to play together under one roof in Toronto, and then to eventually play in AAU tournaments and get noticed, that was probably the biggest thing. And then that's when you started to see Canadians go one and done. And then the NBA, it started with guys like Junior Cadogan and Tristan Thompson and Corey Joseph. And these type of guys all came through that program.
Let's talk about the, well, 1995, the Raptors and the Vancouver Grizzlies both come into the NBA. So Canada now has two NBA teams, right? And what was, if any, what was the impact of that on not only the popularity of the sport broadly in Canada, but participation or development on the amateur side of the game?
It was a huge moment, the formation of the Raptors specifically and the Grizzlies as well. And I would say you kind of have to break it down, and this is something that I came to realize over the point of writing the book, because I heard so much about the Carter effect, right? Which is Vince Carter putting the Raptors on the map, making them must-see TV, growing the interest around Canada in basketball. And it really can't be underrated. It was huge. But I also think you have to separate inspiration, which is what the Carter effect was, and development, which the Raptors played virtually zero role in, right? The Raptors didn't come to Canada and make all these grassroots clubs or leagues or whatever. They didn't do that. Sure, they sponsored some stuff at the community level. The Steve Nash Youth League was kind of run, funded by Nash, run by the Raptors, but they were not in charge of developing anyone. But definitely in terms of the inspiration, it was significant. Every NBA player that we watch, you know, like Canada's a little different in that regard, where we kind of know where a lot of the American players are from, but we don't associate them too much with like that team. Whereas like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Jamal Murray, Dylan Brooks, RJ Barrett, all these guys grew up going to Raptors games and were Raptors fans. And I think that is just important, because like them getting to the NBA might not have happened if they didn't go to those games as kids, see it up close and personal, develop real affinity for some of the players on the Raptors in those days, then, you know, go and develop and do that stuff on the side, which was a separate thing. But yeah, I think the Raptors coming to Canada, it was really the start of the kind of boom and the kind of golden generation of players that we have today.
And we're here with Orin Weisfeld, author of The Golden Generation. You brought up the Grizzlies, so I've got to ask the question. I actually worked in the NBA during the 6-year run of the Vancouver Grizzlies. Big market, diverse market, state-of-the-art building at the time. What happened? Why are they playing in Memphis?
Well, that's a separate question, but no. That's a question I think Canadians are still trying to answer. We would love a second NBA team, and I think there's a few markets in Canada that it would work, and maybe Vancouver would work. I think, but the biggest thing, maybe two things. One is ownership. You know, the Raptors just had a more stable ownership at the time, and the Grizzlies, I know they were trying to change it and get another Vancouver-based owner, and it just didn't happen. So I would say the biggest thing is just you need stable ownership, or else someone with bigger pockets could come in and do what happened and relocate the team. The other thing I think is big is Damon Stoudemire. Like when the draft happened, I think, so the Grizzlies actually got a better pick than the Raptors in 95 when they both came to the league. It was a coin toss, and, mm-hmm. and the Grizzlies got the pick before them. And everyone wanted the Raptors to draft, I think, Ed O'Bannon, who was like a big man. And
oh, yeah.
They draft this guy, Damian Stoudemire, who's like a 6-foot point guard, and he immediately could play. And he immediately, not only that, but he immediately was like a really entertaining player. And the Grizzlies didn't have that in their first few years. Like, they didn't have that guy to rally around, to have like an entertaining style of play, and then also a young player that you could root for and kind of project into the future. So I think Damon Stoudemire really helped the Raptors survive in the early days when they were playing in a baseball diamond. They didn't have like a lot going for them. They weren't winning games, but the Grizzlies, by their early draft kind of mishaps, didn't have that same product that the Raptors did to kind of cling to early on.
I want to ask you about the Raptors World Championship. So we're going back to 2019 on this. But I was in Toronto that night. Now, the game was in California, as you know, but I was in Toronto watching on a huge screen on the street when the Raptors won. And I will never forget the reaction that thousands and thousands and thousands of people just on the one block where it was that they had. I mean, they just erupted. And Oren, I know you were writing about basketball, you know, then as now. And what do you remember about that win and the impact and what that did for the game, even just on an inspiration level in Canada?
Yeah, I definitely. Luckily enough, I was not working that night, so I got to be a fan.
But you got to have and some it was fun definitely one night.
Of the, exactly. It yeah. was definitely one of the most fun nights. We all kind of congregated after everyone celebrating whatever neighborhood they were in. We all congregated in Yonge and Dundas Square, which is kind of like our Times Square. And there was like, I don't know, tens of thousands of people climbing street poles, climbing buses and streetcars. And it was a real amazing moment because I think Raptors fans and Toronto sports fans in general just never thought it would happen. Like, we are a pretty starved fan base. We've had a lot of bad luck with the Leafs, and the Blue Jays haven't won since 93. And as you guys saw in the World Series, not the most lucky city sometimes when it comes to sports. So that championship, it just like everything went right that year and nobody thought it was going to happen. And so when it did, it was a real relief, a real exhale. I remember talking to Zach Edey, who is the Memphis Grizzlies starting center when he's healthy, 7'4", big man out of Purdue. He's a Toronto guy, and he said that, like, because he's young, so when that championship happened, he was still in high school. And he said that, like, watching the Raptors win the championship made it feel like basketball was, like, a less American thing. Like, it was a thing that we could now take pride in and that we could now kind of, like, show, okay, we have something here, too. We have accolades. So I think just that speaks to the inspiration it had on a generation, for sure, of kids who maybe were paying a bit of attention to basketball, but everyone got into it by the end of the playoff run. Everyone was watching. And so certainly, like, numbers, participation numbers shot up right after that happened. And we're not even really seeing the impact on that, I don't think, yet. Like, that's something that's still coming. And I would say, just in general, the Masai Ujiri era of the Raptors, consistent success for so many years, it had a profound impact on growing the game in Canada.
Well, Oren, I think that, you know, Canadians should have taken pride in their ownership of basketball due to the fact that the game was invented by a Canadian.
That's fair, but I guess, yeah, no, I like, for whatever reason, James Naismith has not had a mainstream, you know, following or appeal here. And maybe that's because he did move to America and lived there and kind of grew the game there. But yes, everyone knows that basketball was invented by a Canadian, but I dig a little bit into the history in the book. And like, I think six of the original members of the YMCA, where basketball was invented in Springfield, Massachusetts, they were Canadian. So as soon as the game kind of got developed, they brought it back to Canada and it started growing in YMCAs throughout the country. So yeah, it was very early on here, one of the biggest sports. but it took a long time to have the mainstream appeal that it has today. But it had these niche pockets around the corner dating back to really the invention of the game.
I love that little tidbit in the book, The Golden Generation. There's some historical pieces in there, Oren, that I just did not know, or at least didn't connect it. I've known the name James Naismith almost my entire life. I visited the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts when I was maybe 8 or 10 years old. Didn't know he was from Canada. Likewise, Canadian policy toward immigration, at least for, you know, the most of the past few decades, that's been well known, but the, you know, the impact that that has had on the game. So really nice, you know, didn't know that. So really nice job connecting, you know, the big dots and the smaller ones too. You dropped a hint at the beginning of our conversation here that I want to come back to. And, you know, you'd mentioned that when we get to talking about participation and development in the game in Canada today, that what we see in so many sports where money and commercialization are playing a role is now playing a role in basketball in Canada too. So give us a snapshot of what's going on there and then we'll dig in.
So when I was growing up, even like a decade ago, for example, public school basketball was basically where it was at. Like you usually went to the school in your neighborhood. You played there. There was a lot of really good programs, a lot of good coaches in those schools, even though they were teachers as well. You know, they just took it really seriously and built up really good programs. And I grew up in a basketball culture at Oakwood Collegiate Institute, which I went to high school. It was just, we had one of the best teams in the city. Every game after school, the whole student base would go down to the gym and sit, and hundreds of kids watching. And slowly over time, kind of beginning in the early 2010s, we've kind of seen a boom of the privatization at the high school level and prep schools, obviously following what happened in the States with IMG and Montverde and these kind of schools, kind of basketball centric. Finley Prep was really one of the big first ones, basketball centric institutions that kids go to, and they specialize in basketball. And if they're not paying, there is some sort of tuition, but they might be getting that paid for by the school if they're good enough. But in Canada, the same thing has happened. And the prep schools are great for like the elite players, the top, let's say 100 in Toronto. But for everyone else, for the kid that just wants to like have fun with his friends, play a team sport, get the physical exercise, the public school programs are dropping off like constantly. So we just don't have that anymore. We have, you know, great programs for the very best kids, not a lot of access for people who just want to play casually. And that's at the school level, but something very similar is happening at the club level, where there's just not a lot of good programs that have been around on a kind of non-for-profit level. But there's a handful of really good programs that are, you know, for the best kids, for AAU or club, and they cost a lot of money to play if you're not at the very top. And a lot of parents see this and think, okay, I need my kid to go to this program because this is where the best players pay. And even though my kid's not the best, I'm willing to pay $10,000, $20,000 a year to give him or her that leg up. And that's kind of what we are in the early stages of, is the more money you have, the better opportunities your kid can have in basketball. And unfortunately, it's a really difficult decision for the parents because there's just so many programs out there. There's so many options. And that also leads to this kind of, I think, it's in America too, anywhere where there's kind of this market-based system, you see a ton of turnover. Kids going from one program, and if they don't like it, or if they're not being treated right, or if they're not playing, or if the coach yells at them, they're going to another program the next year and another program the next year. And that's something that I think really hurts the development of kids, because you're not playing with the same teammates, you're not with the same coaches, you don't have an understanding of what the expectations are. Whereas in Europe, you can stay with one program from the time you're 12 years old until you're a professional, and you're in the gym with professionals from the time you're young, because that's where the senior team also is playing with the same kind of style. and you know what it's going to take to move up to the next level, and you grow with the same people in the same style. And I think that's just probably the biggest advantage Europe has over North America right now, is that stability for kids, whereas our kids are going from one program one year to another program another year. And that really doesn't help you when it comes to just like focusing on getting better.
You know, Oren, we talk a lot about that here on Skin in the Game too. And, you know, first of all, it's not always the best kids that are in those programs. It's the kids that can afford to be in the programs, right? And then it's also the specialization. And we've spoken to a lot of professional athletes on this program too that say, you know, we encourage youth to play multiple sports. Don't specialize. Don't play basketball 12 months a year. Don't play hockey 12 months a year. And that was always the beauty of house leagues, YMCA leagues, police athletic club leagues, you know, the stuff that, quite frankly, I had when we grew up. Hopefully this tide turns and people realize that, you know, this isn't in the best interest of the kids.
Yeah, I hope so too. I don't really know what the solution is, because we are in the infancy of what has happened in America for the last few decades, which is to say that the money is only starting to pour in, right? Only now are people starting to see how much money and how much goodwill and all that you can make off just having one pro player come out of your program. With that, there's always going to be an influx of kind of bad actors, people who are in it for the wrong reasons. And I think, unfortunately, in Canada, there's becoming more and more of that, because we are just in the early stages of people seeing how much money is in elite youth basketball. But there's obviously solutions, whether it is like the government stepping in and creating some, like in Canada, you don't need, America's the same, you don't need anything to be a coach. You don't need a certificate. You can form a prep school, you can form a club team tomorrow without any actual training. And so that is something that I know Canada right now has been looking into, potentially creating some sort of certificate that you would need to take if you were to become a coach, but it's never as simple as that.
Yeah. Well, and Tim, as you know, we talk about the commercialization of, or the privatization of youth sports. It is now at the congressional levels here in the States, and they're taking a look at, you know, how do we start to reverse this trend? Hopefully, because Canada's still at the beginning of this trend, they can learn from some of the mistakes that, you know, have been happening here, and how at the end of the day, it's not great for the kids and it's not great for the, you know, for the talent either.
Yeah, it makes you want to stand up and say, please, please, please look to Europe and not the United States for how to do this. Let me ask you a think out loud question. I might be connecting a point here that is a stretch, but the excitement over basketball at the pro level and, you know, and at the international level too, and we can get into this before we wrap, like, you know, Canada's had some real, you know, some real success at the international level too. That excitement over the game at the highest levels, do you see that playing into the way parents are thinking, or the way kids are thinking and asking their parents to invest?
For sure, because if basketball is a means to an end, the end is I want to play for the Raptors, I want to go to the NBA, I want to make millions of dollars, I want to be on a shoe box and cereal box ads. Like, if that's your goal, you see a lot of these cases actually in the NBA recently where guys, clearly they have all the talent in the world, but their hearts aren't in it, in the same way that, like, if basketball is an end of itself and you want to just play because you love the game and see where it takes you, then that's very different. That's a more healthy model, and that's the one that we should encourage. So I think, yeah, it's both parents and kids seeing, you know, their favorite athletes on social media and all that, that in some cases they are viewing, you know, sport as a means to an end. I think we need to just do a better job of kind of encouraging the other model, which is you can never project where the game's going to take you. We should be encouraging the kind of the love for the game. And that does come back to, like, not specializing too early, not burning out too early, being with coaches who are in it for the right reasons from a young age. All this sort of stuff is probably intertwined.
Hey, Oren, kind of as we start to wrap up here, I do want to kind of preview kind of where the state of basketball in Canada and where is Canada, you know, as far as its international competition, right? I mean, obviously, U.S. is always in the hunt for international tournament wins, Olympic wins. Brazil has had a strong history. Australia had a nice run. Even the small country of Slovenia has had a run, right? You know, what can we look for kind of going into 2028 in Los Angeles?
Yeah, it's a really exciting time if you're a fan of international basketball, which I am. I love international basketball. I think it's the best form of it because you get NBA players, you get the best in the world, but you get FIBA rules, which to me are superior. 10-minute quarters is ideal, and they're wearing their flag, and there's kind of a different pride that comes from that. It's a really exciting era. I think Canada's ranked 5 right now in the world. They won a bronze medal at the 2023 FIBA World Cup. You know, they beat Spain and then they beat USA in the bronze medal game. And then they lost to France in the quarterfinal of the Olympics in France. So that was a big learning moment for the Canadians because we just hadn't been to the Olympics in 24 years. So none of this era of guys had ever experienced anything near playing in Paris in front of 20,000 against France. I think, you know, we had the superior team, but those are one of those experiences that you have to live through in order to kind of know how to win the next time they come around. And LA 2028 is a huge deal because, you know, it'll be the peak for age-wise for this era of Shea and Jamal and RJ Barrett and Andrew Nembhard, and all these guys will be around 30. And we just don't know beyond that. You never know. Like, Steve Nash played at the Olympics in 2000 and everyone thought it was going to be the start. And then in 2003, he was done playing internationally for the rest of his life. Like, you don't know with all the demands on the body that the NBA has, how long these guys are going to continue to play internationally. So I think 2028 is kind of their best chance because of what I said about the primes. Also because of where USA basketball is right now with Kevin Durant and LeBron James and Stephen Curry all kind of aging out of their primes and that next generation not quite being there to take up that mantle. So I think Canada has a chance of definitely winning gold in 28. They have a new head coach who's starting this summer who I know is going to bring a very different approach in terms of more of an international style of play, wants to set the roster as soon as possible, bring in some FIBA guys, not just an NBA team, and we'll see what happens. But yeah, I think people are really excited here, and certainly if we ever were to take down the USA on the international stage, that would be a huge, huge moment in Canadian sport.
And how about on the women's side? How are the women stacking up, and how do they look internationally?
The women have been a lot more successful than the men at the international level in the past few decades. They've qualified for all the recent Olympics. But right now, they're in a little bit of a different state where we have a ton of really exciting prospects who are just now getting into the NCAA. I don't know if you know, like Silas Swords, who's at Michigan, and she's really good. We have Toby Fournier at Duke. We have like a ton of high-level prospects who are going to make their way to the WNBA and the pros, but they're really young. So I don't expect the women's team to compete for medals in 2028 necessarily, but they're going to be a force to be reckoned with basically going forward from here. The infrastructure of women's basketball just lagged behind that of the men's by about 10 years or so because the resources weren't pushed into it as much. And it still is lagging behind a little bit, but it's catching up. And I think, yeah, from 28 onwards, the women's team is definitely going to be really competitive.
Yeah, Oren, I appreciate it in the book too that you made clear there's a whole story to be told, probably another book to be written about the women's side of the game, and with the WNBA coming to Toronto as well, probably a lot of inspiration that's going to elevate. So we'll keep an eye on that. And listen, really enjoyed having you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys having me. It's a exciting topic for sure. Whenever we get to talk about Canadian basketball and like to bring it back to what was said at the beginning, like sometimes you don't realize how, like, we obviously, the hardcore sports fans in Toronto or Canada, we're always thinking about how like the Americans are underrating us, right? And I think it was cool, like in the finals last year, to have four Canadians on the floor at a time, like in the Pacers and Thunder series. I think that was a big kind of coming out moment for Canadian basketball in general, just to see so many NBA players playing at the highest level, Shea obviously doing what he's doing. And so it's cool that they're kind of finally making that name for themselves and everyone is beginning to really catch on.
The book is The Golden Generation, How Canada Became a Basketball Powerhouse by Oren Weisfeld. Oren, we'll have to have you back and looking forward to the next conversation.
Awesome. Sounds good,
guys. Thanks, Oren.
Hey, thanks.
Go Raptors.
Snowmaking, more lifts, more ways to play. Holiday Valley is a mix of exciting terrain on an independent mountain that brings out your best. From the first chair to the last run, Holiday Valley is what winter was made for. Holiday Valley, your winter done right. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Skin in the Game. John, it was good to talk Canadian basketball. And I'm going to start right here. I'm going to jump right in. I'm sorry to hear, however, that Canadian basketball, we knew it about hockey already, but Canadian basketball is starting to grapple with some of that over-commercialization, over-investment, stuff that's not necessarily the best for young kids, for young athletes. So a lot more to talk about, but let's start there, because I'm guessing you probably weren't shocked, but also weren't happy.
Yeah, you know, and then think about basketball. Yes, AAU here in the States is a big deal. And, you know, players like LeBron James left high school to go play in the AAU. But, you know, what was always the major asset of a sport like basketball, or in some ways a sport like soccer, is you need a ball and you need a hoop, or you need a ball and you need a lawn, right? You know, you look at some of the best players in both the NBA as well as, you know, Premier Soccer, and a lot of times, you know, they started out in, you know, in their backyard or in the streets, right? And played the game and learned the skill and didn't get burned out and did it for the love of the game. And as Oren said, you know, aren't doing it for the end game, which is a big contract in the NBA, because that's a few of the few that get to that point. So let's hope that Canada can learn from some of the mistakes that we've made here in the States on this privatization and over-commercialization of youth sports. Because with the exception of private equity, it doesn't help a lot of other people.
Private equity at the major league, and I'm saying this any major league sport at the big league level, that's one thing. But when we are talking 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 18-year-olds who are still high school seniors, people really, really need to remember to look at this as something fun, something developmental, not, you know, not a fast track to a, you know, a D1 scholarship here or, you know, some big league contract.
What was really interesting, and again, and Tim, thanks for bringing Oren Weisfeld into the podcast, into Skin in the Game, was really intrigued about kind of the history of the book. And quite frankly, you know, what happened with the opening up of the borders in Canada and how that really was a boon for the sport of basketball. It's nice to talk sports, but it's also even better when there's a historical perspective to it.
There was some great history in this book. And for folks out there who want to read the book, The Golden Generation, you're not going to spend a lot of time going back several decades. He does a great job telling you about the sport today and in the last several years or the last decade or so, and giving you a good sense of where we're headed. But the history that is in there really helps you see how public policy and, you know, the historical context of a, you know, of a country in this case can impact the development of a sport. And pretty straightforward, not an easy thing to do, but a straightforward line of events here. Pierre Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, opened the border beyond European countries. And so you started getting this real diverse mix of people coming into Toronto. And for people who visited Toronto over the years, if you're old enough to have visited Toronto in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and early 2000s and today, you can see it's gotten bigger and it's gotten far more diverse. And that's at a population level. That's also impacted the population of young athletes and the bigger population of young athletes who will play the sport. And so, I mean, that's been great. Certainly wasn't done to make basketball better, but it's been great for basketball. and great for that country too.
Yeah, and it just also, you know, it does correspond with some of the lacking participation in hockey. And part of that is we love the game of hockey, but there are barriers to entry. There's only so many rinks. There's only so much ice time. There's also a financial hurdle. It's an expensive sport to participate in. But basketball, and as we talked about soccer, you know, if you're new to a country, it's a little easier to, you know, to find your group and go out and find a passion, in this case, basketball. So, you know, there's definitely a correlation there. And I also thought it was really interesting is how Oren also brought up the fact that basketball internationally is now, you know, ranked in the top five and really aggressively looking for a gold medal, or not a gold medal, but at least a medal in the 28 games. But you flip that, you know, and internationally, at least on the junior hockey side, you know, you're seeing Canada struggle. So really interesting how these paths are converging.
It is. And, you know, this conversation made me think back, John, to one of our very first Skin in the Game interviews. And this goes back about a year and a half. We had on Jack Armstrong, started his basketball career as a D1 coach at Niagara University. Got fired from that job after about a decade, as happens with coaches. Rather than coaching again, he started working in Toronto as a broadcaster for the then very new NBA team, the Toronto Raptors. And, you know, Jack has become an institution in Canada. And, you know, when he was on Skin in the Game, and I'd encourage people to go back, dig back in the archives, find this episode, I remember it vividly, you know, Jack describing how, you know, in those early days, he and other people associated with the Raptors were really working hard to sell the game of basketball in Canada, right down to he developed a bunch of catchphrases, as announcers will do. Part of it was to have some fun with the broadcast, and because the Raptors weren't so good, but it was also a way of, you know, consciously making the game as entertaining as could be. So the Raptors, over the course of time, became a great team, and there was already that entertainment value built around it. And you know, Jack will tell you, hockey is still Canada's national game. Nothing's changing that. But basketball is also a nationally accepted game in Canada. So, yeah. You know, I'm sure Oren would agree with that. He's writing about it from the other side, from the amateur end and youth participation. So it was great to bookend those two conversations.
Yeah, and as you, there's room for both. MLS soccer does very well up there. Right. The sport of the professional women's hockey is doing very well in Canada. You know, rinks are still full for NHL games in Canada, and now, you know, we continue to see growth on the NBA side. So there's room at the table for all the sports. Bringing this conversation to a close and back to full circle is, you know, making sure that the youth in Canada and the U.S., have the opportunity to experience these sports at a grassroots level, find the passion, and, you know, and compete, even if it's just at a club level or a house level.
100%. And I'm going to drop in one other thumbs up here. So happy to see the WNBA coming to Canada, well, later this year in Toronto. So that'll be exciting. John, this has been a great conversation. I think next time I see you, it'll be back here in the studio.
Okay, we'll see everybody next week. Skin in the Game is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. You can also catch up with all past episodes on btpm.org/skininthegame or on Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.